Today, there is no basis for this mad legislation. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one that is post covering finance and property news. Well, yesterday, John Adams and I on In the Interests of the People channel put up a very important post with 24 hours to go before the misinformation and disinformation submission deadline closes. And we went through in significant detail the arguments around this legislation and why the whole basis of it is false. The reason we've done this is because we had several requests from people to help with regard to thinking about what a submission might look like. So hopefully, if you listen to this show, you might get some ideas. You've still got time to make the submission, although I do note that we have continued issues on the government website, and that is not just a question of the wrong browser. There's something more substantive going on there as well. Anyway, this show is a replay of what John and I said on In the Interest of the People, because this is such a critical issue, the future of Australia depends on it. Hi, John.
Hello, Martin. How are you today?
I'm extremely well, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's in the early hours of Sunday morning here in Australia, and it's the middle of the day for you in the UK. But Martin, I thought it'd be very critical that we come back and do another very quick emergency post, given that there is only 24 hours until the end of the submission process on this misinformation, disinformation bill. So just to take the audience back one step, we did a show last Monday with Robbie Barwick, and that was done very quickly, given that this had just come out. And over the last seven, or probably the last 6 days, there's been a lot of media coverage about this particular inquiry, this piece of legislation. There's been a lot of activity on social media as well. One thing I'll say, Martin, just before kickoff, over this weekend period, so it's Sunday morning here in Australia, in the last 24 hours, there's been quite a few protests across the country about this misinformation, disinformation in terms of the legislation. Over the last few days, there's been requests for an extension to give people more time to make a submission. I actually did that myself. I spoke to the committee secretariat late last week, and basically they said that the committee was going to meet to consider an extension, and if an extension was granted, there'd be some sort of announcement. So we've got 24 hours to go, and so far no extension has been granted by the committee. And so it could well be that on Monday, there is some sort of last minute extension. But if that doesn't come, the audience who's listening to this recording only has literally 24 hours to prepare a submission and to submit it to the Environment and Communications Legislation Committee, and for people to have their vital say on this piece of law, law.
Yeah, very important, John. A couple of other observations. I made the post with you and Robbie. I also made another show with Adam Stokes, which is also up there on my channel now. And interestingly, quite a few pieces of feedback that we got, if you look at the comments. Firstly, people were making a lot of submissions, but secondly, people had significant problems actually getting through to the website. And in some cases, they just weren't able to get in. And the official position is that try a different browser, but I have a suspicion that maybe there was a capacity issue on the website. So another reason for looking for an extension is because the website wasn't necessarily as accessible as it should be to receive submissions.
Indeed, indeed. Now the thing is, Martin, so I think there's just in case if people haven't made a submission yet, and they're thinking about making a submission in the next 24 hours, I think it's just worthwhile just to go into some more accurate detail about what's really going on. Because once you get into the detail, this misinformation, disinformation legislation from the Albanese government is way worse than what we were saying about 6 days ago. So I just want to give some basic context, and then we're going to get into why this is even worse than what we thought it was going to be. So just so the audience is clear, so the what is the difference between misinformation and disinformation? So the proposed legislation says that if something is reasonably verifiably false, misleading, or deceptive, that is misinformation. Now, when that information is pushed out on social media deliberately, that's disinformation. So the difference between misinformation and disinformation is the in terms of intent. So that's probably the first thing that people need to understand. The second thing that people need to understand is that the proposed law provides the regulator, the Australian Communications and Media Authority, additional powers, and those powers ultimately will allow them to make certain rules and certain standards on social media companies or what they call digital platforms. And if those rules and standards are not abided by, then they'll have the ability to impose fines. And so this legislation doesn't actually regulate the content or the activities of individual users, but it's basically going to the platforms and saying, if you don't comply with these new rules and standards about misinformation, disinformation, well, then we're going to impose fines. And obviously the theory of that structure is that then the social media companies will start clamping down on their own users. And that's how the censorship will actually come into being. So that's, I think, important for people to understand that this is not a law where the government will directly censor the content or the activities of individual users, but they're going to impose significant fines if rules and standards are not abided by the companies themselves. Now, Martin, there's three key documents people need to understand if you want to actually get to the technical aspects of this. So there's a lot of people on social media who are talking about the philosophy of this law and how this is the antithesis of core Western values, particularly around freedom of speech. But once you get into the specific detail, there's three documents people need to read. The first one is the actual bill, the proposed law. The second document is the explanatory memorandum. And this is a standard document that comes with every proposed bill before Parliament. And the explanatory memorandum really goes into some explanation as to what the bill is about and goes through the various sections of the bill to explain what do those sections actually mean. And then there's a third document called impact analysis, or the impact analysis report. Now, going back to the 1980s, the Reagan administration in the United States came up with this concept of regulation impact assessments, and that was in the mid to late 1980s. That was implemented by the Hawke government in Australia, and this has been a long-standing practice. So for a long time they've been called regulation impact statements. Now they're just called impact analysis reports. But basically they're looking at what is the cost of the regulation in terms of what is the cost on the economy, what's purported benefits does it generate, and does it generate more benefit relative to costs? And that's what that impact analysis report is looking at. So I've had the opportunity over the last 6 days to go through some of this, and I'm just going to cover some of the key concerns I have with this. Now, the whole basis for this misinformation, disinformation law, so usually there has to be a problem that they want to address. And so they talk about a particular report, Martin. If we can put slide one on the screen. So there's a report called Adult Media Literacy in 2024, Australian Attitudes, Experience and Needs. Now, this document, according to the explanatory memorandum, is the core basis for why we need this law. The problem with this report, Martin, is that there's two chapters. One chapter talks about misinformation, and the other chapter talks about what they call offensive content. And offensive content is, around sexual exploitation, violence, and things of that nature. Now, once you actually read this report, Martin, even though there are some people who have concerns or with misinformation or who can clearly identify that misinformation is actually happening on social media, there's not one reference in this report where they say that Australians want misinformation to be censored off the internet. So while people say that they can see it, they don't want the government to do anything about it. Now, when you get into the chapter about offensive content, only 34% of survey respondents want offensive content taken down. So just to be clear here, the whole basis of the law is based on this one report, and no one in the report says take down misinformation. And yet when you get to the more extreme sort of elements around offensive content, only a minority of people want the government to actually take it down. So in essence, Martin, there is no one in Australia who wants this law. And the government says we're doing this based on a report, and there's nothing in the report that says Australians want content taken off the internet. And when I read this report a few days ago, Martin, this was the big shock, that there is no basis for this. No one's asking for this. The government is saying that there's a report out there that is the reason why we're doing this. And the report, when you read it itself, no one in the report is saying do this. So this is why the title of the show is The Lies of Misinformation, Disinformation. The Albanese government has gone out of its way to lie and mislead the public to say there is a problem. And yet the report that they say is the basis of the law says there's no problem. The one thing I'll say about this aspect of misinformation, they do say in the report that older Australians trust social media companies or social media platforms less than younger Australians. But the question then becomes is, so why do older Australians trust digital platforms less? Is that because they can identify misinformation better, or is it because they are less familiar with new technology and they're more used to traditional media, which is TV, radio, and print, and they just don't trust new stuff? I would say that is the latter, but again, that is the essence of this whole law, a report where no one says take it down, and the only thing that they can say is there is an older group of Australians who trust social media companies less. They don't say why these older Australians trust these social media platforms less. Once I started to read the explanatory memorandum and go into this report, I was just shocked that there is absolutely nothing backing up this proposed law.
No, and as we discussed in our earlier show, John, in a way, my theory was that this was a bit of a knee-jerk reaction from the government, partly perhaps because of The Voice and what happened there, and partly with other issues, because social media includes a lot of criticism of the government, probably rightly so, and sometimes the government would prefer that criticism not to be aired. But of course, they need a basis on which to prosecute this particular legislation. And so that report that you highlighted is effectively, ostensibly the basis. But when you actually read that, you realize that there's a complete break between what that report was saying and what they've chosen to do.
Absolutely. Now, Martin, when you look at the impact analysis report, they talk about the need to address social costs. So they have this vague reference that misinformation, disinformation causes social harms and that causes a social cost, and the government needs to address that. And yet the impact analysis statement doesn't actually articulate what specific social costs is the Australian public suffering from. What are the specific examples, and why does this particular law address those social costs? It doesn't go. I mean, it's all wishy-washy, vague. And again, what is the big problem we're trying to solve here? I mean, one of the interesting things about these documents, Martin, is they give a number of examples of what they call misinformation or disinformation. Most of the examples provided in the report are not even Australian examples. They are foreign examples. And so, but when you are designing a law for Australia, you need to be able to understand, well, how susceptible are Australians to misinformation, disinformation? Are we more gullible or less gullible than other populations across the world? Because if we are less gullible, well, then we probably need these laws less than other countries. This report and this analysis says nothing about it. And the more concerning thing, Martin, is that there are some examples where they say this is misinformation, disinformation, and they're actually not. So let me give you one example. So they talk about one example of misinformation is the Russia, so-called Russian interference in the 2016 US presidential election. Well, that whole Trump-Russia narrative, that's been debunked. It was a hoax. It was a hoax by Hillary Clinton. And the US Department of Justice appointed a special counsel called John Durham. And if anyone looks up the Durham report basically says that there was a document called the Steele dossier paid by the Hillary Clinton campaign. It was full of lies about Trump-Russia. And then that was used by the FBI to open an official investigation called Crossfire Hurricane. And that was the whole basis of creating this whole fake narrative that Trump was somehow involved in the Trump was somehow colluding with the Russians. The Russians were interfering in the US election. And then obviously you had, you know, a few years ago, you had Four Corners series on this. You had Hillary Clinton going on Four Corners saying that Julian Assange was part of Russian intelligence. It was all fake. It was all fake. This was all a hoax pushed by Hillary Clinton. And yet this whole so-called Russian interference in the US election, which didn't happen, this is one of the examples why we need this law. And they can't provide accurate examples of misinformation or disinformation. And yet they're basically pushing fake narratives as the basis for this law. And I just find this completely ridiculous.
Well, in a way, they are doing precisely what they're trying to claim that other people are doing, which is actually using misinformation and disinformation to try and justify the misinformation and disinformation bill, which I find, concerning, not to say a little bit amusing at one level. And I will also add, John, that, of course, there is this point that she's actually come out, this is Rowland, she's come out and said, we have to do this to meet our international obligations, which begs the question then, so where precisely did those obligations actually stem from? And is that another example of misinformation, disinformation in its own right?
Well, interesting you should say that. So in the last few days, I have spoken with Robbie Barwick, and he tells me that the Australian government has signed a memorandum of understanding with a particular part of the UK government around this sort of legislation. So you've got the Albanese government talking to the Americans, talking to the British and to the Europeans, because the European Union has said that misinformation, disinformation is the top policy priority. And so you have all these elites across the world saying, we've got to do something about this. And yet the Australian people have said, there's no problem. The government can't articulate any problem. And yet there's somehow some sort of secret international deal, and they're now just trying to foist this whole law on the population, and there's absolutely no policy basis for it. Now, Martin, one of the interesting things with this impact analysis document is that they provide some quantitative costs as to what will this cost social media companies or digital platforms to implement these proposed laws and all the various requirements under the law. So they give a dollar figure. But when it comes to the benefit of this particular law, so they say there's a social cost on society. They say we're going to introduce a law that's going to impose a financial cost on social media companies. And yet, when it comes to, well, what is the benefit, they haven't been able to articulate the benefit in precise terms. There are no quantitative estimates as to what the benefit would be to society. And so even on a cost-benefit analysis, there is no evidence that these laws will actually produce a net benefit for society. The government's own documents has done nothing either qualitatively or quantitatively to actually show that this is actually going to result in a overall benefit for society. And you know, when governments, and you know, just so people understand, Martin, in 2008 and 2009, I actually worked in the Department of Finance in Canberra for the Commonwealth government, and I was actually in the deregulation area. So when Kevin Rudd became Prime Minister, he had a deregulation agenda that was under the Finance Minister, Lindsay Tanner. I was actually working in that unit, and it was obviously a core principle of making new laws that you would only do so if you can clearly demonstrate that there was a net benefit to society. And with this particular law, the government, in its own documentation, hasn't been able to show that this law will actually produce a net benefit.
No, absolutely. And you could argue, John, I think again, that this is form over substance. So they have to tick the box because they're required to tick the box or try and show some financial benefit. But when you actually pare it back, you realize that there is no benefit here. And those figures are rubbery at best and probably completely made up at worst. And there is no justification from any benefit, whether it be financial or whether it be social, to actually go forward with this bill. But again, I want to underscore, unless, of course, you happen to be in government and you feel that you are being over-criticized by the people on social media and you don't like it and you're trying to turn it off.
Yes. Now, one of the key points, Martin, or one of the key questions, and this is the sort of core question you raised in our show, in our last show with Robbie, is who determines what is the truth? So who gets to judge what is misinformation, disinformation? So the legislation basically says that if something could be quote ver reasonably verifiable to be false, misleading, or deceptive, that will meet the threshold of misinformation, disinformation, and the difference between the two is intent. So it's good, but this is the key test: reasonably verifiable that it's false, misleading, deceptive. Now the question then becomes, Martin, is well, who gets to make that judgment? It's very interesting that the former Prime Minister Tony Abbott, in the last few days, came out and said, well, Albanese promised that electricity prices would fall by $275 per annum per household, and electricity costs have gone up under his government. So, was that promise before the 2022 election, was that misinformation or was that disinformation? Or what was Albanese actually doing when he made that claim, which has not proven to be true? Now, again, the legislation provides no clear guidance as to who's going to make these decisions as to what is the truth and what is, reasonably verifiably false, misleading, deceptive. But in the explanatory memorandum, Martin, it does actually provide a, like, again, not a precise guide, but a bit of a guide. And it provides, a few options as to who would determine the truth. So they talk about third-party fact-checking. They talk about expert opinion. They talk about verifying claims against multiple reliable and independent sources. And then they basically say, well, if there's a history of a claim continuing to be made that has been clearly been debunked, well, then they could do something about that. Now, Martin, if we go to slide two, the key issue here is when they come with in terms of third party fact checking. Well, the ABC had a third party fact checking organization, and this was at RMIT University, and that unit was full of people who was pro voice during the referendum, and the ABC was forced to cut ties because the fact checkers were not actually checking the facts. They were actually only checking the facts that they supported their predetermined narrative on the referendum. And the whole fact-checking organization became discredited, so the ABC had to cut them. And this is obviously, this article we're showing on the screen is by Sky News. So, to say that independent fact-checkers are going to be the arbiters of the truth, well, we already have a problem with that because the ABC had a fact-checking organization via an Australian university, and they had people who were biased in that fact-checking unit, and that organization has been discredited. Now, one of the points I've made, Martin, is that in the context of economics, banking, and the financial system, which is one of the key concerns that you and I have with this particular law, you have, even in terms of so-called experts, completely, they have different opinions about economics, about financial conditions, and so who is going to make these judgments? So the regulator, the Australian Communications and Media Authority, they don't have the expertise to make judgments on finance or economics or banking, and so we've been called conspiracy theorists on a number of economic issues, and over the last few years, we've got more right than we did wrong. You had the current RBA governor telling the Senate in 2022, no one could have foreseen the inflation, and yet you and I were doing shows in 2020 saying the inflation was coming. So you know, the so-called experts in 2020 said that the stimulus was necessary to stave off the in terms of the economic impact of COVID-19. And then you get into 2021, Philip Lowe basically said, well, interest rates were not going to go up until 2024 because there'd be no inflation. And yet the inflation came in 2022, which we said all along. So, but you and I are not considered experts according to the elite. And yet the so-called experts got it categorically wrong. So how can you say that experts are going to make a determination on contentious issues? And obviously our realm is economics and finance, but even on other things like public health or politics or elections or referendums, etc., experts will disagree. And so how do you, you know, what I consider to be true, you know, for example, the kook, Kokoulos, would say I'm wrong. And what he says is true, I would say he's wrong. So again, this whole notion that social media platforms or the media regulator has the expertise to be able to determine what is the truth among so-called experts or non-experts, it's just a completely unworkable law that has not been thought through at all.
I agree, John. And the other point I'd make is that, of course, they carve out politicians and the political system, the mainstream media and universities, who are sort of pushed out over there and everybody else is caught within this. But actually, even if you look within universities, you'll have different points of view and different opinions, strongly argued about particular things that are completely, you know, at odds with each other. So the notion that there is some objective point of truth that can be always anchored and used at a point of reference is actually illusory in my view. And unfortunately, what it means in practice is that the form of truth that the ruling political party believes to be true will be ultimately the hurdle. And therefore, I have a major problem with that.
Now, when it comes to conference, apparently addressed with misinformation, disinformation is to prevent imminent harm to public confidence in the banking and financial system. So when you go into the actual document sets and you get to what does this actually mean? In essence, Martin, what they say they're trying to avoid is bank runs. So what they don't want is, obviously we've discussed this on numerous shows, that the RBA, APRA, ASIC, Treasury, etc., they're all focused on financial stability. We've got the biggest debt bubble in the history of the world, and they want to keep this debt bubble and these financial markets stable, because once things become unstable, i.e. September 2008 or March of 2020, things can start to get out of control quite rapidly. And once they do, it's hard to contain, you know, the situation, particularly if large financial institutions become insolvent. So that's what they're trying to avoid. But here's the key problem is, so one of the examples they cited in the explanatory memorandum was Silicon Valley Bank from March of last year, March of 2023, when there was a number of tweets online. There was a massive withdrawal of capital from the bank within 24 hours, and then the bank ran out of money and they basically declared insolvency. And that was the biggest regional bank failure since the GFC. Now, the problem with this example, Martin, is that in the explanatory memorandum, so they basically say that the tweets that led to the initial withdrawal of capital, some of the tweets were true, and they say a lot of the tweets were false. Because there was an independent study done after the fact. So if you're trying to prevent a bank run and you're trying to say, hey, if there's any online chatter that could trigger a financial collapse of an institution, we're going to try to put a stop to that so that there's no disruption to the financial market. Well, the legislation says they're going to censor if it's false. And yet with Silicon Valley Bank, some of the tweets were true. So even in real time, so think of Martin, you know, again, the thing I think about is, if you think about the referendum or elections, I mean, these are, there could be social media posts that you can take a few days to verify. But if you're talking about preventing a run, and there could be, there could be some rumors circulating, and there could be tweets going back and forth over the space of a few hours. Well, if some of the tweets are true, if some of the tweets are false, how can you determine the truth in the space of minutes in real time in order to prevent a bank run? And the answer is you can't. The only thing that, if there was a suspicion that, for example, CBA was going to collapse tomorrow, and they didn't want and they were afraid of people saying false things online that would amplify concerns of the public that would trigger a bank run. They would, basically what would happen under this law is they wouldn't care about the truth or what was false. They would just try to censor and just try to suppress all commentary so that no bank run would happen. And yet that's the concern that I guess you and I have is that they can't determine the truth. And if there is genuine concerns about the health of a financial institution or the financial markets, people should have the right to openly discuss these things on social media without any censorship from the government.
Well, I agree, John. And it's worth just recalling back in 2007, 2008, we had coups of people in the UK worried about a particular financial institution or two, and they were actually filmed on the TV. Shown, to be worried about it, and the treasurer came on at one point and said, "There's nothing to see here. Don't worry, everything's safe." That actually catalyzed yet more people to actually go and withdraw their money because they didn't believe the treasurer. So the fact of the matter is that even if somebody from government comes out and says everything's fine, folks, people won't believe them anyway.
Yes. Now, Martin, just to round off this conversation is, I just want to focus on this exclusion of what you said in terms of government, but also the politicians in terms of the journalists. So they're the ones exempt from this legislation, and it's basically, us little people on social media, on these digital platforms, we're the ones being captured on this. Now, Martin, if we can go to slide three, because I think this is so critical. So there was a report called the 2024 Edelman Trust Barometer Australia Report. And what this report found was, so they do these reports all over the world. And so in the Australian report, they found that 59% of Australians are worried that government leaders, business leaders, and journalists and reporters are purposely trying to mislead people by saying things they know are false or grossly exaggerating in terms of the truth. So the reason why this is important, Martin, is that the government says there is social harm from misinformation and disinformation, and we need to shield the public from this. And yet, when you look at the actual data from other sources, who is the Australian people afraid of or worried about? It's not people on social media. A majority of Australians are afraid that the ruling elite, government, business, and media figures, and journalists and media commentators, they're the ones lying to the public. So if there was any policy basis for this law, it would be to say politicians and journalists and media companies and established media companies, they're the ones that have to be captured by this law because that's what the public is afraid of. I mean, the public's not afraid of me, John Adams, pushing misinformation and disinformation on Twitter. The public is afraid of the Prime Minister or the Australian Financial Review or Channel 9 or Channel 7 or Channel 10. They're afraid of those people lying to them, not about me lying to them. This proposed law is targeted at you and me, Martin, and we look at this independent data, and a majority of the country is not afraid of you and me. They're afraid of the elite, and the elite are trying to create this law that exempts them and targets us. So the whole policy, the whole design of this law is in the complete reverse. The government's trying to point a bazooka at us, and yet the public's saying, no, point the bazooka back at you, government, because you're the problem, and also point the bazooka at the mainstream media because people do not trust them. And I just think that this carve out for journalists, given that the Australian people, 60% of the Australian people, 59% of the Australian people think that the journalists are lying to them or exaggerating the truth or hiding the truth from them. Again, there is just no basis to have these exemptions in the law at all.
No. And again, it goes back to the point I made earlier on. The fact of the matter is that the government has been losing a lot of its arguments simply because of the fact that social media have been turning a spotlight on what they've been saying and doing. And that's partly because people don't actually trust what the government is saying and doing. And rather than the government cleaning up its act and being true to its own mandate, it's just continuing to go down various rabbit holes, but then actually try and silence it rather than actually deal with it. So they should turn the spotlight on themselves, it seems to me.
I'm just going to finish off with one example that they cited. What they said was misinformation. And this is when, in the last few months, when we had the unfortunate attack in the Bondi Westfield shopping mall, where it was a knife attack, there was a lot of speculation on social media within the first couple of hours as to who the murderer was. Unfortunately, someone from the Jewish community was wrongly identified on social media as the person who was the purported attacker, and that person was never the attacker. And so this was an example provided in the explanatory memorandum to say, well, see, this is how misinformation can actually cause harm, because someone was defamed and they were wrongly identified as being a criminal when they weren't. The problem with this example, Martin, is that let's put slide 4 on the screen. Well, Channel 7 also made this mistake. So yes, there were some people on social media who wrongly identified the attacker, but so did Channel 7. And Channel 7 was forced to not only issue an apology, but was forced to provide compensation to the person who was wrongly identified as being the Bondi attacker with the knife. And so again, the whole policy basis in terms of mainstream media to be exempt, people on social media can make a mistake. So obviously, if it's not intentional, it's misinformation. People on social media can make a mistake. Mainstream media can make a mistake. So why target us but not target them if we're all capable of making mistakes? The other thing I'll say, Martin, is that while this person was wrongly identified on social media, within the space of probably 90 minutes to 2 hours, the market was able to correct itself. So as more information came out, as more things were being able to be verified by a range of sources, people started to realize that the person who was wrongly identified was not the attacker. And so while that person had been defamed over the course of 1, 2, 3 hours, I mean, the market is self-correcting. And so it's not a sort of misconception that went on for weeks or months. And so again, if you're going to provide this example, you've got to realize that the so-called misinformation wasn't just pushed by individuals on social media. It was pushed by Channel 7, a mainstream media outlet as well. And yet, even though there was false claims made, that only lingered for a few hours until people realized that the attacker was someone completely different.
Absolutely. And I like the idea of the market and the market self-correcting, because, of course, in an open exchange of ideas and opinions, that's going to be tending to what's happened. But if, in fact, what you're doing is putting the finger on the scales so you don't actually get a full range of views and opinions, you can actually then push the truth off in a particular direction to suit your own ends, and the market doesn't work.
Indeed. So, Martin, in terms of bringing this show to a close, here is if anyone has yet to make a submission, this is your last chance in the next 24 hours to do so. And so the key messages are, there is no policy basis for this law. No one is asking for misinformation or disinformation to be removed. The government hasn't articulated how is this going to work in practice. The government hasn't been able to show how this law will produce a net benefit for society, and there is no basis for why certain groups get exempted and everyone else has to be captured by this law. And so this is a bad law with no basis, and it's likely to cause actually more harm to society rather than less harm. And that's why the public at large needs to rise up and say to the Albanese government, stop the madness and drop it. Now, the only last thing I'll say, Martin, is that in the last couple of days, the coalition has formally come out to say they oppose this law. And so when we look at the dynamics in the Australian Senate, if the Greens come out and say that they oppose this law, well, then the Labor won't have numbers to actually pass it. Now, if the Greens do say they support this law, then with the coalition, every crossbench senator has to join with the coalition to say no in order to block it. And so there's definitely still some more politics to be done between the Greens and the crossbench. But I think the first stage that all of us can play a productive role is to make a submission and to make our voices heard. And a number of these key points that I've been able to glean from these documents, I've prepared a submission, which I'll submit in the next 24 hours. And I think just before we started recording, Martin, you also talked about the importance of public hearings. So I'll be pushing again for public hearings if they do come about, and we'll obviously have to see what the committee does.
Yes, and I just want to say, I think a public hearing or two would be quite beneficial, but of course they get a lot of flack if they held them, so perhaps they won't. And I just want to underline to everybody again that the 30th of September is the current deadline, may change. Second point is that you can make a submission by clicking, as you saw in the slide a second ago, and going through and registering and making a submission. It's pretty easy. There is also an email address as well. And as I said earlier on, some people have had trouble making the submissions through the formal mechanism, but the email system is working. John, I want to leave you with this thought. This is actually a quote from Carl Sagan, one of the people that I really look up to. And he said, "A cure for a fallacious argument is a better argument, not the suppression of ideas." And to me, that quite nicely encapsulates the whole basis of doing the right thing here and making sure that free speech and free debate can continue. So there you have it, a very important set of arguments from John. And if you haven't made a submission yet, you have 24 hours left to do so. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.